And invite you tonight to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis 11. Tonight we're going to be looking at verses 1 through 32. And our text tonight finishes what some call the prologue of Genesis. The prologue that covers from the very beginning of all of time up until the beginnings of the Jewish nation and the family of Abraham. And tonight we're going to look at this whole chapter together. And as we do that, there's no way that I can address or cover every detail. But what I want to do is I want to give us kind of an overview picture of, I think, a couple of the main ideas that are being communicated to us in this chapter. And hopefully we can see God moving in His grace, in His wonder in these verses and apply them to our lives. I'm going to read the whole chapter and then we'll take some time to look at it together tonight. Genesis 11, verses 1 through 32. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." So they used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. And that is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. This is the account of Shem's family line. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And after he became the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arphaxad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. And after he became the father of Shelah, Arphaxad lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he became the father of Eber. And after he became the father of Eber, Shelah lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he became the father of Peleg. And after he became the father of Peleg, Eber lived 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he became the father of Reu. And after he became the father of Reu, Peleg lived 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he became the father of Serug. And after he became the father of Serug, Reu lived 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he became the father of Nahor. And after he became the father of Nahor, Serug lived 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he became the father of Terah. And after he became the father of Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and had other sons and daughters. After Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This is the account of Terah's family line. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran became the father of Lot. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans, in the land of his birth. Abram and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was childless because she was not able to conceive. Terah took his son Abram his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. Really, there's two ideas that I want us to think about tonight from this text. And I'm going to approach it by asking two questions. And I'm dividing the text up into two sections. The first section is the Tower of Babel incident in the first part of Genesis 11. And the question that I'm going to ask and try to answer there is, what is the problem with the people at Babel? So what's the problem with the people at Babel? Why does God come to confuse their language? Why does he come and visit them in judgment and disseminate them and scatter them by confusing their language? And so that's the first question. What's the problem with the people at Babel? And then the second question I'm going to ask of the second portion of the passage that is primarily the genealogy, the account of Shem's family line. And that question is, what's the purpose of this list of people? So what's the problem with the people at Babel? And then the second part of the text, what's the purpose of this list of people at the end of the passage? And so let's look at the first one, the first question. What is the problem with the people at Babel? I think as we read this narrative, the main answer to that question is the problem with the people at Babel was pride. The problem with the people at Babel was pride. And so as we reflect on what they decided to do, as we reflect on their building project, as we think about some of the statements that they made, I think it becomes clear from the text that this is a witness to an ancient people who were lifted up in human pride. And they desired to come together, to unite, to see what they could achieve, and what they could accomplish as human beings, autonomous and independent of God. See what we can do in our own strength, in our own wisdom, in our own skill and design, and see how much of a name we can make for ourselves. And I think there's, as you read through this passage, and some of these insights are not my own, as I was reading and studying in this and reading in some of the commentaries, they brought out a few ironies that I had really not considered and thought about before. Ironies that make their project seem ever so small when you think about it from God's perspective. And I just want to draw out a couple of those to show you how ludicrous their project was from God's eyes, from God's views. And so it says, first of all, just I want to think about the first couple of verses because I want to tie it into what we were talking about last week in chapter 10. It says that the whole world had one language and a common speech, and as the people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. So I want to relate this to chapter 10 because last week in chapter 10, what we saw was really an account of three separate genealogies, the three genealogies of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and it showed how they spread out into different regions in the different parts of the world. And in chapter 10, it even talked about how they spoke different languages in those different parts of the world where those descendants of Noah spread out. And we talked about this a little bit last week. I just wanted to address it again for a moment. And that is, how does chapter 10 and chapter 11 relate to each other then? If chapter 10 is saying these people are all spread out and they're speaking different languages, how does that fit in with what we're reading now in the Tower of Babel? That there's one people all together in one place speaking one language. I think what we have is we have an intentional arrangement of the story in which the writer Moses is trying to show to us what happened immediately after the flood. And so to show us immediately what happened after the flood, he has to start with all three of Noah's immediate sons, right? So he starts with those three sons, and he starts to trace it out of what happened to those peoples. And what he does in chapter 10 is he traces it really all the way out for some distance. And I think what happens in chapter 10 is, as he traces those three families out, both in terms of time and generations, as well as geographically, in terms of where they spread out, I think what he does is he overshoots the event of the Tower of Babel, if that makes sense. So he's doing that to show where these three lines ended up, to show the different regions where they ended up. And now what he's doing in chapter 11 is, I think he's going back and he's showing us, it's almost like he's given us the overview in chapter 10. Now he's going back and he's kind of bringing the lens to focus on a particular incident that happened in the middle of that course of events of chapter 10. And I think there's even a hint to that in chapter 10, in verse 25, where it says that there were two sons that were born to Eber. One was named Peleg, and it brings out the significance of his name, which means division, because it says, at that time, the earth was divided. So that's an interesting comment, because we have a genealogy in which we're just going from parent to child, one generation to the next, and we see this pattern just repeated over and over again in chapter 10, but there's this one little comment inserted into the genealogy about Peleg and the earth being divided. So clearly that's something significant that Moses wanted us to think about. And I think chapter 11, many commentators think, and I think they're probably right, is that chapter 11 is that event that is referenced by the meaning of Peleg's name. So we have the earth being divided, scattered, and the event that caused that to transpire was the Tower of Babel. So I think really what we have here is now we're taking a lens and we're looking at a specific event. And so at one point in history, I think we do have all peoples together. They're in a region which we would know today as modern-day Iraq, in the land of Babylon, probably somewhere between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And they're building a city. Some would even suggest that this was the very spot of the ancient city of Babylon. And that's very possible. It's hard for us to determine that certainly with archaeology, but that's certainly possible. And so here's this group of people, and they come together. And I want to point out just a few things about what they're planning to do and even what they're saying about their plans. So verse 3, it says, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And now, notice, there's an end quote there. And then there's almost like a narrative comment on their plans. It says, "They used brick instead of stone and tar instead of mortar." Why is that an important detail? Why would the author, Moses, care to share that with us? Here's why, I think, and this is one of the ironies that was pointed out to me, is that in the land where they're making this tower, this city, they don't have a natural supply of stone. And so they actually have to go through the hard work of making bricks out of mortar and out of tar pits, probably, to try to get this to hold together. And I think what the author is doing is he's showing us they used brick instead of stone, and they used tar instead of mortar. Now, for us in 21st century, maybe that doesn't seem like much, but that'd be kind of like us telling the story of the three little pigs. And one little pig made his house out of straw, and one little pig made his house out of bricks. Right? Which one is better? Well, the one out of bricks, right? And so what's happening is, this is a comment from the perspective of Moses and from the perspective of probably even what the land that they're going to in the Promised Land, as well as the land where they have been in Egypt. And the construction that they're used to is solid, well-built construction made out of stone. But they're making this out of bricks they're making by hand. And the implication is that this project is doomed from the beginning. They're using not even the best materials to make their quote-unquote tower that's going to reach to the heavens. And then, some other ironies in here, it says, they said, come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth. And so, their goal is the heights of heaven itself. Let's make a tower that reaches to the heavens, almost in an attempt to get to God, perhaps, on their own ability. But then notice the comment of verse 5. Here's the irony. What does God have to do to look at their tower? Where's this little tower? I got to come down to see it. Now, God's everywhere, right? God's infinite. He knows everything. He is everywhere present. God doesn't physically have to come down from anywhere to see something. This language is put here on purpose to show, for lack of a better word, the stupidity of the project that they were undertaking. And how small and insignificant it is from God's perspective. That you think you're so great and you're going to build a tower to the heavens, I got to break out my magnifying glass and come down to see it, is what the language is implying. Small, insignificant in terms of God's perspective. And so there's just a few hints in there of how small and insignificant their project is. But here's the thing that we need to wrestle with is they thought, from their own human perspective, that their project was great. They thought it was awesome. They thought it was mighty. They thought it was going to be the most wonderful thing in the world. And they thought, look how all these people are going to praise us. And in that, I think we see our own hearts sometimes. And we see our own hearts when we think, hey, I'm going to do this so that this person will see it and will compliment it and will... It'll give me a good praise, right? And so there's pride in their hearts, but we also need to see the pride in our own hearts. That there are times in our own hearts when we want to do something great so that other people will see it and praise it. But I want to draw out their pride here in three ways. I want to show you their pride in three ways in this passage. One is the pride of rebellion. The pride of rebellion. And the what I'm thinking of here is the fact that they say, let's not be scattered over the earth. Let's come together as one and be in one place. And many have said, and I think they're correct in this, is that they are intentionally not doing what God had told both Adam and Noah, which was to multiply and do what with the earth? To fill it. So go and fill the earth. God, as creator, he says, I have made this huge expanse of an earth, and I want you to go and I want you to fill it, and I want you to rule over it under my authority for my glory. And they're just huddled here as one in this one little place. And so they're not spreading out. They're not filling as God directed them to do in the original creation mandate. And so there's the pride of rebellion. But there's also in here the pride of autonomous human effort. That is, what we can do on our own without God's help. There's the pride of autonomous human effort. Look at what we can achieve by ourselves when we come together and we put our minds to it. Isn't our culture that we live in now very much like the people at Babel? When you reflect on our modern culture, our modern technological culture, and think about our pride sometimes and what we think that we can achieve, there are many, many times when we sound very much like the people of Babel. Look at what we can do now. Look at all of our technology. Look at how far we can go into space. Look at how small we can see with our micron microscopes. Look at all that we can do. Look at what we can heal in the human body. Look at what we know now. We're so wise, and we live in an age in which we think we're so wise that we're throwing off thousands and thousands of years of world history as if they were all backwoods cavemen. and didn't know what they were thinking when they said marriage is a man and a woman. Thousands of years, even if you don't accept the Bible as true, as your authoritative source of moral authority, it should at least give us pause to stop and think that we're about to do something as a society that no society has ever done, and that is to give legal recognition on the same level, same par, as that of regular marriage between a man and a woman. And we think we're so enlightened and so advanced that these previous generations didn't know anything and didn't have any wisdom. And it's very easy for us to become, in our society, lifted up in pride, in our own human autonomy. Look at what we can do without God. And then we see this in the Tower of Babel, in the people there. And they were very much seeking to reach the heavens in their own strength. And there's probably a commentary here on man-made religion, on the instinct that is in all of us as human beings to try to reach to God and make our way to God on our own path that we create for ourselves. And I think the lesson that we see here is that doesn't work. It never works to try to reach God, to reach the heavens on our own. There's an immeasurable gap there that we can never cross in our own human effort. And so there's the pride of rebellion, there's the pride of autonomous human effort, but then there's also the pride of arrogance and glory seeking. Let's make a name for ourselves. Let's have everybody say that we're great. And the interesting thing about this is that God says to Abram, when he calls him in the next chapter, I'm going to make your name great, and you're going to be a blessing. So what does God do? God lifts up the humble. He says, I'm going to make your name great. But those who lift themselves up in pride and say, we're going to make ourselves great, God says, no, I'm going to humiliate you. And I'm going to bring you down. And so they wanted a great name for themselves. They wanted people to recognize how great they were. And so there's the pride of rebellion, the pride of their own human effort apart from God's help, the pride of arrogance and seeking glory for themselves instead of seeking the glory of God. And God says, in response to that pride, I'm going to judge you. I'm going to judge you. And so God, His response to the problem of human pride is judgment and humiliation. He humbles the proud. And He scatters them across the face of the earth. And so the text says, God comes down and He says, if as one people, now verse 6, speaking the same language, they've begun to do this, then nothing that they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. And so the Lord scattered them there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city, which is why it is called Babel, because the Lord there confused their language and scattered them over the face of the whole earth. And so God's response to human pride is judgment. It's the same pattern that we see all the way throughout Scripture. What was the response to the pride and the human autonomy of Adam and Eve in the garden? Adam and Eve thought, we can do this ourselves. We can reach out and take hold of the tree and we can be our own gods. And God, in response to their human pride and their desire for godlike wisdom apart from God, God punished them. And in very similar language, it says that God came down and He excluded them from the garden and kicked them out of the garden and set up guards to keep them out of the garden so that they would not take hold of the tree of life. In very similar language, we see this here, God coming down and scattering the peoples in judgment. And so, what's our hope then? What's our hope? Because what we see in the people of Babel is what we see still in our human hearts even today. We are still a prideful people. In our human condition, our sinful condition, we still tend toward pride and arrogance and self-seeking. We still tend to want to glorify ourselves instead of glorifying God. And so what we need is we need grace, don't we? We need grace. We need to be redeemed. We need a redeemer. We need God to rescue us from His judgment and to rescue us from our condition of sin. And so we are in need of redemption because of our pride and our arrogance and our rebellion. Because that pride, arrogance, and rebellion brings the judgment of God. And so we need His grace and we need redemption. Which is where I think the rest of the passage comes in. Because what's the purpose of this list of people at the end of Genesis 11? The purpose of this list of people, the answer to that question is, the purpose is to show us the providence of God in the outworking of His plan of redemption. The purpose of this list of people at the end of Genesis 11 is to show us the providence of God, and by providence, I mean the way in which God works in the world, in the affairs of humanity. Often in ways that we can't perceive, behind the scenes, moving and shaping the events of world history so that it arrives at His intended goal and destination. God is weaving and shaping the events of history, unfolding His plan of redemption for His glory, for our salvation. That's what this list of people is. Because I want to show you what is different about this list of people from the list of people that we saw in chapter 10. The list of people that we saw in chapter 10 is a list, broadly, of all three of the descendants of Noah. Started with Japheth, then Ham, and then ended with Shem, which is really the backwards order. Why does he end with Shem? Because that's where the focus is now going to be. So Genesis 10 ends with the line of Shem because that's the focus now. And so when we get to Genesis 11, verse 10, who is the only son of Noah who then is traced out? It's Shem. So now in the story, all we're concerned about is the family line of Shem. And so we read through these names, and where do we end up? We end up with Abram, don't we? We end up with Abram, who becomes Abraham, the one whom God made a covenant with, the one whom God came to and said, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make your name great. Unlike these people at Babel who sought to make their own name great, I am going to exalt you and make your name great, and I'm going to bless you. Whoever blesses you, I'll bless them. Whoever curses you, I'll curse them. And in you, all families of the earth will be blessed. And so the purpose of the end of Genesis 11 is to get us from Shem to Abram and to show us the outworking of God's providential plan of redemption. And so I want to show you just a few things from Genesis 11. One insight that I think we see in Genesis 11, this list of names, is that death still reigns. Death still reigns. Now, when you look at this pattern, I'm going to read just a couple of verses to remind us of the pattern. Look at verse 10. This is the account of Shem's family line. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And after he became the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters, period. But if this were in Genesis chapter 5, what would come next? And he died. Now, Genesis 11 does not include that little phrase after each step of the genealogy. But the pattern is exactly the same as that of Genesis 5. This person lived X number of years, had this key person as his son, descendant, and then lived another X number of years and had other sons and daughters, and this person lived a total number of X number of years, and he died. That's the pattern of Genesis chapter 5. We see that pattern unfold all the way throughout Genesis 11, but there's something missing, and it's the little phrase, and he died. What this is called is, this is called an ellipsis. An ellipsis is where you say something once And then the second time you say something similar, you don't finish the statement, but you assume that the person that you're talking to understands mentally what you intend to communicate. It's like you leave a gap there where the rest of the sentence would be. That's an ellipsis. And oftentimes when you use an ellipsis, by leaving something out, sometimes you actually draw attention to the thing you leave out. And so just because the phrase is not here and he died, don't think that these people didn't die. Because they did. And by rehearsing this pattern for us, the exact same pattern that we saw in Genesis 5, our minds are intended, the author wants us to complete the phrase for him. This person lived X number of years and he died. So death still reigns. The problem of death is still around. The flood didn't fix that. The flood didn't fix our problem of death. God told Adam, if you take of this tree, the fruit of this tree, and eat of it, you will die. Paul says in Romans 5, by one man, death entered into the world, and so we all die because of Adam's sin. We see that unfold in Genesis 5. We see it unfold now. We see it unfold in our lives. We see it unfold here in Genesis 11. Death still reigns. Death is still a problem. We still need a deliverer. We still need a rescuer from death. Who is that going to be? It's going to be the descendant of the seed of the woman, Genesis 3:15, which is being worked out in God's providential plan in Genesis. Seth, and then Noah, and then Shem, and then Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, and then Judah. On down the line, find a man named Boaz, a man named Obed, a man named Jesse, a man named David, King David, a man named Solomon. We could trace the line. We could rehearse the genealogy from Matthew. And where do we end up? We end up with Jesus. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of this. What this is the providential unfolding of God's plan of redemption. We still need a deliverer from death and the curse. Murder, Cain and Abel, murder, natural death, like we see in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, the corruption of the human race that we saw in Genesis chapter 6, a worldwide flood that destroys everything except Noah and his family, Genesis 6 through 9. None of that can deter God from accomplishing his plan of redemption. None of it. It will come to fruition. And so all of history, including the lives and events of individual people, all these names that are here, all these funny names that are hard to pronounce, these are all real people. These are real people who lived at a real time in history. They had real lives. They had real things that they did from day to day. God used them in His plan of redemption. Providentially guiding and molding His plan, He used each of these individual people as a link in the chain of His plan of redemption. All the way till Christ. By extension, we're no longer waiting on the Messiah. The Messiah has come, but God is still using individual people in His plan. He's still using you, you as a church body, you individually, us collectively. He's using us to accomplish great things in His plan of redemption for the world. He might use you to win your neighbor. He might use you to win your coworker. Think about the people that were influential in you coming to Christ. You know, I've thought about this in my own life. I thought about the fact if I didn't have, when I was little, if we didn't have neighbors that lived down the road from us on this little country road in Minnesota, and they didn't stop at our house and talk to my parents and invite them to church and share with them the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, I would not be standing here today. God used that family in my parents' life. They came to Christ through their witness. Their son was born like 12 days after I was born, he became my best friend during the 8 years that I lived in Minnesota. We went to school together. We went to church together. That family was incredibly instrumental in my life. God used them as his instruments to bring my family, my mom and dad, and me to Christ. Who did God use in your life? Your parents, grandparents, friends, neighbors? Who did God use? Even go back a couple of generations. It's amazing when you think about it, isn't it? It's a complex web of God's providence at work in our lives. God is still using people to accomplish his plan. God's using these people. And so he's extending his plan through Shem, through Abraham, to bring us to Christ. And so I want to encourage you with this tonight. In our humanity, we are prone to pride. We are prone to selfish glory seeking. We're prone to desire autonomy apart from God. And our holy God has to judge that pride and rebellion. But this holy God loved us, and this holy God providentially provided for our redemption through his plan to bring a deliverer, Messiah, Savior into the world so that we would be saved. God did that for us. If you're a Christian, this is your family story. Isn't that an amazing thought? If you're a Christian, this is your family tree. Because you know what Paul says in Galatians? He says, you are in Christ, children of Abraham by faith. By faith, even if you're not a Jew naturally, by faith, spiritually, you are a child of Abraham. This is your family. This is your story. This is God writing your story of redemption. It's an amazing story, isn't it? It's an amazing story. And I pray that you'll be encouraged by what God does in his providence in the lives of individual people to accomplish his plan of redemption. Not only in terms of the big picture, his plan of redemption in Christ, but also on a more individual level, his plan of redemption of your life, the lives of your family, the lives of your friends, your co-workers, your neighbors. God chooses, in his incredible wisdom, God chooses to use people and their witness and their prayers to accomplish his mission of salvation. We're privileged to be a part of that mission. And it's an amazing privilege. And so God has written your story of salvation, and he's writing someone else's story of salvation, and you might be a chapter in their story of salvation. And I pray that God will use you in his providential grace as he's redeeming others to himself.